Think of inequality in our society as an odorless, colorless, invisible, highly toxic gas that we're unaware of harming our health. Kills us through the usual diseases we die from. Cardiovascular disease such as heart attacks and strokes, cancers, diabetes, kidney and lung disease. These conditions have their origins in early life, and we're among the worst rich nations in terms of supporting early life, and that is when the inequality gas is most toxic. We need to be rescued from this gas, and only we can rescue our future generations so they have the healthy lives they deserve.
That's Stephen Bezruchka, and this is Alternative Radio. I'm David Barsamyan. This edition of AR features Stephen Bezruchka in Sickness and in Wealth. Income and wealth inequalities have huge health impacts. What are the health advantages of being rich as compared to being poor? Well, you'll live longer, and your quality of life will be better. With deep pockets, you get lots of vacation time, live in capacious apartments or houses. You have nannies to take care of the kids, cooks, and house cleaners. And you eat well. Organic arugula, shiitake mushrooms, fresh-squeezed carrot juice. You have access to the best medical care money can buy. You get annual checkups. Whereas if you are indigent, you wait and wait and hope the lump on your breast will disappear, and the pain in your tooth will just go away. Being well off frees you from the mental stress of worrying about where your next meal is coming from and where you will sleep tonight. Our guest today is Dr. Stephen Bezruchka. He's senior lecturer in the Department of Global Health at the University of Washington. He worked for many years as an emergency physician in Seattle. His particular areas of research are population health and social hierarchy. He spoke at Quimper Universalist Unitarian Church in Port Townsend, Washington. And now, Stephen Bezruchka.
I want to begin by focusing on sex. What is the most common sexually transmitted infection? Everyone in this room has been infected. What is it? Lice is the most common sexually transmitted infection. It is uniformly fatal, and there are no cures. I want to investigate how to treat this infection called life tonight. May you live in a time of change is said to be an ancient Chinese curse, although like so many legends, the origin is unclear. Wikipedia says the nearest related Chinese expression is translated as better to be a dog in a peaceful time than to be a human in a chaotic or warring period. Forget the origins. I'm sure all of us agree that we live in a time of change. Technological change, cultural changes, lifestyle changes, workplace changes, political changes, family changes, and changes in health. I want you to consider the changes in health over the last century. I want to try to bring us up to the present by suggesting that there have been three major eras in considering health. I'm not talking about health care, which is the phrase usually used in the United States where we access health, spend on health, ensure health, and pay for health. How many times have you used those phrases? Well, if you don't use them, you certainly hear them all the time. We don't spend on health. We spend on health care. We don't pay for health either. We pay for health care. We can't ensure health because the Grim Reaper is always there at the end of our lives, so we buy insurance for health care. Health and health care are vastly different concepts, and it is not health care that produces health. I say this as a doctor who was pushed out into the medical arena in 1973 to fight the adversary, namely treat illness and injury. Illness and injury were the enemies, and I battled them with my stethoscope, with my scalpel, and with my drugs. And what I routinely did might be considered assault with a lethal weapon were it not sanctioned by society and practiced in the battlefield of the hospital emergency department where I worked. I used to think that healthcare was what produced health. But reflect that all healthcare does, medical care does, is diagnose and treat illness and injury. It's not the lack of medical care that causes illness and injury. All medical care does is diagnose and treat it. So we have to look elsewhere at the root causes of illness and injury. What I was taught at Stanford Medical School in the early 1970s reflected our understanding of what might be called the first era of health. The first era of health recognized that infections were big killers. As a child, my mother worried about my getting polio, so when I developed weird symptoms at the age of 5, I was hospitalized in isolation. In the 1940s, isolation meant that your parents couldn't come into the hospital room, but had to stand outside in an iron grate outside the window and peer in and wave at me and blow me a kiss. Hospitals were constructed with these exterior scaffolds to stop disease transmission. So being healthy back then meant not getting infected with germs, and we developed innovative ways such as these scaffoldings to prevent transmission and produce health. What structures do we need today to be healthy? The public health approach then was manyfold. Avoid getting contaminated, keep the sewer separate from the water lines, vaccinate against acquiring infections, and quarantine those with infections. Steps you took depended on where you lived. For many years, I lived in remote Nepal, a week's walk from the road where there was no public health infrastructure. I saw and treated many cases of tuberculosis and leprosy, as well as injuries that got horribly infected. Treating bad infections was the mainstay of what I did and what I taught others to do. In the beginning of the first era of health, about 150 years ago, we didn't know about germs causing infections. Instead, it was miasmas or being hexed that caused illness. Two things stand out historically during the 19th century to illustrate how one could change health outcomes without knowing the causes of poor health. John Snow mapped cholera case deaths and where they occurred in London in 1848. He discovered the deaths were clustered around those getting their water from a pump on Broad Street. He persuaded the city councilman to remove the pump handle, and subsequently deaths declined. He knew nothing about the bacteria that caused cholera. So I ask you, what is the pump handle in America such that if you did one thing, deaths would decline? Another innovator was Dr. Rudolf Virchow, living in Austria then, who later became the father of modern pathology, that is, the cellular study of disease. Virchow pointed out that diseases such as typhus that were killing people were much more common amongst the poor peasants. He reasoned that the poor peasants suffered from political oppression by the reigning bureaucracy. At that time in European countries, poor laws were being passed. Societies decided to do something for the less fortunate. Why, you might wonder, were they doing this 150 years ago? But European societies were getting incredibly rich from the phenomenal plunder provided by colonialism. Recall the colonial era when England or France or Germany invaded parts of the world to get the raw materials such as diamonds or gold. Remember the Gold Coast, as it was called then. They were then sent home to provide capital that made a few very rich. The rich were getting richer, and crumbs had to be tossed to the poor to keep them from staging a revolt. Thus the advent of poor laws. Rudolf Virchow, writing about these poor laws in 1848, said that doctors were natural attorneys for the poor. His most famous quote, published a few months later, is, "Medicine is a social science, and politics nothing but medicine on a larger scale." Unfortunately, we in the United States were spared these poor laws because we weren't such a colonial power then. Our colonial era came later when there was much less threat of a revolt. In the United States, during this first era of health, remarkably successful efforts to control infections were put in place. A great example was treating people with tuberculosis before we discovered antibiotics that could kill the tuberculosis bacillus. In Minnesota, tuberculosis of the lung became more and more common in the early 1900s, more than 100 years ago, as poor immigrants arrived. There was a very high mortality rate. Minnesota doctors attending a conference in D.C. heard someone from England describe how they segregated TB patients and had a steady decline in deaths. not only from others not getting infected, but also the mortality of those with the infection declined precipitously. These doctors came home and starting around 1910 began opening county, state, and private sanatoria where those with TB were housed and taken care of. The effect was nothing short of a miracle. Once patients entered the sanatorium and had good food and bed rest, their fevers and night sweats declined, the tubercle bacillus disappeared from their sputum, and x-ray evidence of the condition improved. By 1950, when antibiotics arrived to treat the condition, 80% of the drop in deaths had already occurred. Such was the power of social medicine. Take a poor person with the condition, house and feed them well, isolate them so others don't get infected, and they don't die. So the first era of healthcare is that of preventing and treating infections, where you have the magic bullets of antibiotics. They can be effective, but as this example of tuberculosis demonstrates, you don't necessarily need antibiotics. When an infection is treated by an antibiotic, the response is different in a rich person compared to a poor person. Poorer people do more poorly given the same treatment. I saw this all the time working as an emergency doctor, but none of my mentors emphasized this point. It still isn't highlighted for medical students or trainees today, or even spoken of by practitioners. Yet when you point it out and they've had the experience, they agree. Poorer people do more poorly when given the same treatments as richer folk. People in the United States tend to think that medical care performs miracles. Our media hypes this all the time. What the media don't tell you is that whenever you study it, medical care is always a leading cause of death. Part of the reason relates to what my professor of medicine at Stanford said in his lecture back in 1973. In 10 years' time, you will find out that half of what I'm telling you is wrong. I just don't know which half. Medical reversal is the term applied to the situation where we did tests or treatments that we thought were effective but hadn't been sufficiently studied and then later discovered they were not helping or sometimes they were even harming those tested or treated. For example, as a doctor, I was taught that hormone replacement therapy for postmenopausal women was highly effective. Then studies appeared that showed that hormone replacement therapy harmed women. In the 1950s, I was treated for acne by radiation, for a form of treatment for localized facial acne. Today, that's not done anymore. I developed a lump in the area treated that turned out to be a lymph gland cancer that I've had since 1975. This personal example of a medical reversal has profoundly influenced my interest in health and healthcare. So let's consider the second era of health. The first era was infections. The second era of health, well, most of us don't worry about infections these days, although many became anxious when the Ebola outbreak occurred in Africa in 2014. Zika virus is the anxiety agent in the United States today. Well, the majority of us will die from either cardiovascular disease or cancer. These are called chronic diseases, meaning that we're told we have them, cures are elusive, and so we live with heart disease, diabetes, high blood pressure, kidney disease, or various cancers. A vast industry has arisen to take care of these chronic conditions. A major shift in thinking about chronic diseases came as a result of studies that began in the United States in the late 1940s. We discovered that individual behaviors or other conditions made you more likely to have these diseases. We called them risk factors. The risk factor approach spawned a whole industry to change personal behaviors. Exercise was deemed to be good for you. Exercise was something you paid to do by joining one of a variety of what might be said cults that made you sweat, become very sore, get incredibly short of breath, or even get injured in the process. A transition occurred from our being a society where people were paid to work, be it in factories making steel or automobiles, or unloading train cars of pig parts, which is something I did in the 1950s working at a meatpacking plant, transformed to a society where we had to pay to work. Those of us who are fortunate to have a job, these days don't do much physical work at all. We might do mouse work. That is, we are paid to move this little, now tailless, rodent around on the top of a desk. It glides with almost no effort. Others might work in the service industry, where we drive automobiles and don't even get to push the clutch in, or move the shift lever, or roll down the window. No work there. Then we take our hard-earned money and spend it to do some work at the gym, or by taking an adventure vacation, hoping for some adrenaline tourism, such as you get by bungee jumping or skydiving. Notice that poor people can't pay to work. They don't have enough money to do that. The most emotionally satisfying service poor people can pay for is to have their nails done. Why do you see all these nail salons in poorer parts of town? Well, as a relatively well-off person, I have power over others. I teach and so can force my students to do what I want them under threat of their not getting a good grade. But a poor person can't get a job with substantial control over other people. They're always trying to please their boss because they don't want to get fired. By getting their toenails worked on, they pay someone to kneel before them and can sense having a little higher status than that person. Notice this physical supplication the next time you go by a nail salon. There's a hierarchy there, and poor people can get some relief from this low position in society by going to a nail salon. A huge medical care industry has arisen to take care of those with chronic diseases. This is the second era of health care. Notice I said health care, not health. One vast giant is the pharmaceutical industry. We spend half of the world's drug bill in the United States, despite being about 5% of the world's population. We consume half the world's antidepressants, or anxiolytics such as Xanax, and other psychotropic drugs. We consume many more legal narcotics than in any other part of the world. This last phenomenon is amazing. The rise in narcotic prescriptions in this country has been astounding. If you're a pharmaceutical company, where is your market and profits? Is it in preventing an infection with immunization? Is it in curing an infection with an antibiotic? Or is it maintaining a person on lifetime drugs for a chronic disease? There are no profits in preventing an infection, and not many in curing an infection that you then no longer have. But think of the gold mine of diagnosing someone with diabetes that requires lifetime compliance with modern drugs that are incredibly expensive in this country. Or the latest expensive drugs for hypertension, or cancer drugs, which are similarly priced out of the reach of poor people. Consider cancer treatment. It is fascinating to look at trends in cancer deaths in this country. They really haven't changed since President Nixon declared a war on cancer in 1971. It's like the endless war on terror, except that it's a war on cancer terror. Meanwhile, compared to 1971, we have an incredibly profitable industry to maintain people with cancer on astonishingly expensive drugs. Recall my lymph gland cancer that resulted from radiation treatment for facial acne. It was a cancer that couldn't be cured, but could be treated as a chronic condition that I endured for decades. Almost 3 years ago, I underwent aggressive treatment for it with chemotherapy drugs that were available back in 1975 when I first had the condition. My medical bill for this in 2013 was almost $1 million. This didn't involve anything fancy. 3 separate weeks of hospitalization and high costs for those patent-expired drugs made good profits for somebody that year. Something else has happened to the drug companies in that they advertise their products to us and tell us to ask your doctor about. Pharmaceutical companies discovered that their sales and hence their profits increased immensely when they told us about all these expensive miracle drugs that they said would help us. Most of you never read or listen to the fine print in those ads detailing the side effects. When you read the fine print for antidepressants, they point out that this antidepressant may actually cause depression or make you suicidal. Go figure. We're the only country that allows drug companies to promote their products this way. There's a small effort in New Zealand to present drug information to the public, but on a vastly minuscule scale compared to the United States. There's none of this advertising in Canada. So comparisons of revenues with the U.S. show vast increases compared to Canada based on our direct-to-consumer advertising of prescription drugs. In the second era of healthcare, we saw the proliferation of social service agencies to help us deal with chronic diseases. Since poor people have more problems with their health than the more well-off, we now have a vast industry catering to the poor. Notice they cater to the poor. Social service agencies don't try to eliminate the poor, for they depend on having them always be with us. Consider the question of working for social service or social change. Service predominates vastly over social change. So we have close to 100,000 food banks in this nation, whereas back in the first era of health, there were almost none. We have a huge incarceration industry to house the poor. We have a quarter of the world's prisoners in the United States. It's not that they're such bad people, but we don't want the poor to meddle in our lives, so we put them away. Since the poor are thought to have brought their poverty upon themselves, they must be punished, and locking them away is one profitable way. Another is to create housing deprivation. We created a system of housing insecurity through our political system, and then we developed an industry to offer social service to the homeless. It mirrors the incarceration system, except that the homeless are not behind physical bars. There's an explosion of federal, state, and local funding for homeless services, as well as a meteoric growth in nonprofits providing many services. Again, the homeless are thought to have made wrong choices, so their housing deprivation is not seen as resulting from political choices. As you might expect, homeless have worse health and die younger than the non-homeless. We might consider this necropolitics, the subjugation of life to those in power to kill the homeless. Federal government, through its Housing and Urban Development, or HUD program, requires that agencies receiving federal funds have to have a homeless management information system and count the homeless. You get what you measure, so if you measure homelessness and the counts keep going up, you get more funding to support services for the homeless instead of looking at root causes and decreasing the number of homeless. My students volunteer at homeless shelters and participate in counting the homeless regularly. This looks great on their CVs and perpetuates the problem. What appears to be true is that we're grappling with chronic health conditions to varying degrees of effectiveness, and yet sense in this time of change that I began with that something is not right. Being healthy should allow us to do what we want, to have the freedom to enjoy our lives, or at least to feel we are living a meaningful or fulfilling life. Is that happening? Since we consume so many drugs for mental conditions, antidepressants, anti-anxiety pills, and the so-called atypical antipsychotics, as well as vast quantities of stimulants for ADHD, not to mention our astronomical legal narcotic consumption, maybe things aren't all right here at home. So far, I haven't made many comparisons of the state of affairs in the United States with that in other countries. This is a departure from my usual way of talking about health, namely compare our health status with people in other rich nations. To consider the third era of health, we need to take stock of what is happening elsewhere. This is because the third era of health is about being healthy and to do what we have will bring meaning and fulfillment in our lives. Because of the rapid pace of technological change, despite or because of how medicalized we are, despite or because of how hard we're trying to pursue happiness, we don't get the satisfaction we feel we deserve. You might not be surprised to learn that happiness has been declining in the United States over the last 40 years. The decline has been most pronounced in women. The Declaration of Independence didn't give us the right to be happy, just to pursue happiness, and that's something we do with a vengeance. How many times have you told someone to have a nice day today? Or how many times have you been told to have a nice day? Recall, we didn't do this all the time 40 years ago. We're not having nice days like we used to, and telling someone to have a nice day isn't working. I'll say more about women being the bearers of this decline later. There's every reason to be concerned. We die younger and have worse health than people in all the other rich nations, and even some poorer ones. That is, we don't have the long, healthy lives we feel entitled to, given our right to life enshrined in the Declaration of Independence. But that right is not a right to a long life. That we're dead first is not in doubt. There's no counterfactual evidence to suggest that we are some of the healthiest people in the world. Our leading think tank, the Institute of Medicine, said this very clearly in its 2013 report titled U.S. Health and International Perspective, Shorter Lives, Poorer Health. The title says it all. Let me repeat it. U.S. Health and International Perspective, Shorter Lives, Poorer Health. On page 3, they write that even those of us who are white, insured, college-educated, making lots of money, doing all the right health-related behaviors, die younger than our counterparts in other nations. In other words, our poor health applies to all of us, and we can't get out of it by eating healthy, going to the gym, or seeing your doctor, again, if the standard is comparing ourselves with people in other rich countries. I compute a Health Olympics tally every year based on the United Nations Human Development Report. For 2014, there were 34 countries where people lived longer, healthier lives. In the 1950s, we were one of the healthiest nations in that we had the longest lives of all countries. When I went to Stanford Medical School in 1970, we stood 17th among nations. When I went to public health school in 1992, we were 22nd. Now we're 35th. To achieve this, we spend $3 trillion on medical care in 2014. Fully a sixth of our total economy and almost half of all the money spent worldwide on health care. Clearly, the first and second eras of health care are not producing health in the United States. Something else that plagues us are health inequities. Namely, some of us have much worse health outcomes, that is, greater mortality than others in the United States. These health inequalities are not unique to this country, but are found in most places and can be characterized as poorer people having poorer health. But it is even more than that, as the Black Lives Matter movement has demonstrated. Those that die the youngest in the United States are American Indians, then African Americans, and then whites. The range of mortality differences among these groups, health inequities I call them, are the greatest found in all rich nations. I could go on and detail more killer facts, but I'll spare you this execution, but just point out that there isn't any vital statistic we do well in except spending money on health care. We lead the world there. You're rightly asking, why is this the case? Why are we dying much younger than people in so many other countries? What is the third era of health care that is required to produce a third era of health, namely bringing fulfillment to our lives?
You're listening to Stephen Bezruchka in Sickness and in Wealth. This is Alternative Radio, celebrating 30 years of independent broadcasting. You can order copies of this program by calling 1-800-444-1977. That's 1-800-444-1977. Or you can order online on our website, alternativeradio.org. That's alternativeradio.org.
In my career as a doctor, only a few things stand out in my becoming critically aware of producing health, and I'll detail these. First, what we do as individuals to be healthy doesn't matter as much as we're told. The observation that transformed my thinking here came from recognizing that twice as many men smoke in Japan as in the United States, and yet they're the longest-lived country and have been so since 1978. Smoking's not good for you, but compared to other factors, it isn't that bad. A second critical realization for me was recognizing that a human population is the entity to study, understand, and treat. Japan's Smoking Gun points out that if something is going right in a population to produce health, then what the individuals do or don't do for themselves doesn't matter as much as what is happening to the society. So what does Japan do? Ask yourself if you've ever seen a lone Japanese tourist. Then consider if you've ever seen a lone American tourist. Therein lies their culture of social solidarity, which is critically important for health. Western Europe is considerably healthier than we are. Western Europe, that is the European Union, spends over half of all the world's total social expenditures, while it's only 6% of the world's population. I've talked about social service expenditure in this country, but Europe's is different. Their social expenditure doesn't focus on the undeserving underserved, but is universal, so society takes care of everybody. That's the vital difference. By the way, Michael Moore's new movie, Where to Invade Next, depicts this very well. See it if you can. Third, medical care's impact on our health is relatively minor. I've already described enough about the first and second eras of healthcare to explain that. Studies show that countries that spend more on social expenditures than on medical care have better health than those that focus on medical care. Among rich nations, we spend the least on social expenditures and focus instead on medical expenditures because that's where the money is. Fourth is a concept that ties it all together, which is the realization that early life lasts a lifetime. Over 150 years ago, Frederick Douglass, an escaped slave abolitionist and intellectual, said, quote, "It is easier to build strong children than repair broken men." It is easier to build strong children than repair broken men. This aha moment for me started almost 20 years ago, and I began considering the importance of the first 1,000 days of life from conception onward. This is the life course approach. Namely, conditions we're exposed to in early life program our health status as adults. Roughly half of our health in this room has been determined before we go to school. There's an intergenerational component as well. We all started life in our maternal grandmother's womb. That is, where the ovum that begat you was produced by your mother. At birth, your mother had all the eggs already fully formed. It only required the sexual infection of your father's sperm, fertilizing the egg that produced you. So at least your maternal grandmother's circumstances have to affect your health. And life is the most common sexually transmitted infection, and it is responsible for us being here tonight. This developmental origins of health and disease perspective points out that we need only to survive to reproduce, to ensure the survival of our species. So in early life, the fetus and infant make crucial decisions that allow reproduction to be successful. In stressful or anxious circumstances regarding the future, these biological and physiological adaptations enable reproduction but result in paying a price in later life. Cost turns out to be most of the chronic diseases we face as we age. This includes various mental and emotional issues, diabetes, kidney and lung disease, hormonal cancer such as breast and prostate, cardiovascular disease, high blood pressure, and many others. Why we're dead first among rich nations relates to our lack of building strong children. Instead, we repair broken men and women. It's very profitable, so that's why we do it. The third era of health is living fulfilled lives. The third era of health care recognizes the importance of early life and the life course and the need to make populations as the entity for intervention or treatment. Early relationships matter. They matter before we're conceived, before we're born, and before we enter school. Of course, adolescence matters, but not as much. The resiliency to do well in life is also programmed early on. So how do we build strong children? Several key principles here. A girl is a mother from the time of her own conception. That is, what happens to a woman before she becomes pregnant matters more for the health of her offspring than what she does while pregnant. In this country, we focus on prenatal care. But what happens in those 9 months is not as important as what happened before. So women in this country are not doing well health-wise and compared to women in other rich countries, and even a few poor ones. I'll detail three killer facts unique to U.S. women. A 15-year-old girl has a smaller chance of surviving to age 60, something called adult mortality, than a girl in Sri Lanka or Panama, not to mention all the other rich countries. For another, the United States is only one of 8 countries worldwide who've seen a rise of deaths of women in childbirth over the last decade. We stand there with Afghanistan and South Sudan. Third, mortality is increasing and length of life is actually decreasing for women in a significant fraction of U.S. counties. These mortality increases are not seen for men. A major reason for women having worse health is the huge expectation placed on women in this country and the corresponding lack of support. As a woman, you have to have a successful career, be a devoted wife, a soccer mom, have the looks of a supermodel, the physique of a jock, and you have to be a porn star. That's impossible. Meanwhile, we men are the same old jerks we've always been. Nothing more is expected of us. Being a successful woman is almost an unachievable task in this country. Hence the declining happiness among women that we've noticed over the last 40 years. What do other countries do to support their women? Well, there are only 2 countries on the globe with populations over 1 million people that do not grant a working woman paid time off after she has her baby. The other country is Papua New Guinea, half of a big island north of Australia. In case you missed it, we do not give women who've had a baby paid time off work after the baby is born. Paid time off results in women breastfeeding longer, which is very important for health and development. And surprisingly, studies show that women who take time off to mother become stronger in the workforce after the child has grown. There's no downside to supporting paid maternal leave. We don't support parenting in the United States. Besides not having time off to parent, we don't provide much financial support to families. And we in the United States have the most child poverty of all rich nations. Why do we tolerate this despite declaring a war on poverty in 1964? It's like the war on cancer. It serves economic needs in this country. It has become a war on the poor. To illustrate this, let me describe one cartoon to you. Visualize 2 well-dressed men with heads facing each other, and the caption says, "Of course we need the poor, Herb. How else will we know what it means to be rich?" It's like the relationship in the nail salon I described before. We don't have a national or universal daycare program that is free or low cost, as in Sweden, say. In many public school districts, a number of students in high school are homeless, and we have all these services for the homeless. We outsource parenting. Parents go back to work after the baby is born, so infants and children are raised by others. Rarely is the same person there in the child's life for a long time. Studies of secure attachment find that you need a single pair of eyes in front of the baby for the first year of life, and then a second pair of eyes in the next year. It's best if these eyes are there for a long time afterwards for really good things to happen. It doesn't have to be the mother and the father. In the first year of life, it could be the nanny, and in the second year, his boyfriend. Much of the stress and anxiety in our society stems from the chaotic conditions during pregnancy and parenting. Technology hasn't helped either. A lingering image for me is that of a mother sitting with a little infant trying to crawl up on her foot, large doe eyes gazing upwards towards her. What's the mother doing? Something smart, 2 thumbs on a smartphone. These are changing times we live in today. I've described what we don't do well in this country. What do we need to do? Well, the IOM report I mentioned before, U.S. Health and International Perspective, Shorter Lives, Poorer Health, documented our being dead first and spells out what to do. First, they say, inform the public that we have worse health than those than people in the other rich nations. The second is to look at what healthier nations do that might be of use here. That advice brings up the question of how do people in the United States come to believe something is true? The answer is simple. Since we simply have powerful people in the public's eye repeat the concept over and over. This works very well. Consider the example back in 2002 when almost every second phrase emanating from the federal government was, Iraq has WMDs. Despite the lack of evidence for this statement, it was repeated over and over until the public believed it. This justified invading two nations that cost us $4 trillion, not to mention losing about a million lives. What worked was endless repetition. We could do that again. We need to find the right phrase. It could be, we all die too young. Just say, we all die too young.
We all die too young.
Say it again.
We all die too young.
Okay. Suppose that mantra was spoken by the president, by those in presidential election debates, by senators and congresspeople, by governors and representatives. People would begin to ask, what do you mean that we all die too young? That's your opening to talk about our being dead first. The second piece of advice from the IOM report asks us to look at what healthier nations do that might be of use here. I've already talked about what other countries do. The first would be to pass a comprehensive, substantial, paid parental leave policy. Let's go with 39 weeks of paid parental leave with the father having to take 13 weeks. Many rich nations have such a policy. The pay would be their salary up to a limit. Where would the money come from? Well, there are various funding options in use around the world. I've mentioned Sweden that funds, and it funds parental leave by the national government. Sweden's government commands over half of all revenues through taxation. And Sweden spends more government money on the first year of life than in any subsequent year. They front-load life course spending because they realize they don't have to repair broken men and women later. Canada funds this program through various provincial policies. Typically, the unemployment insurance pays your salary at 60%, and the employer often tops it up. Mothers in Canada expect that their government is there to support them and their children. In other parts of Europe, it's funded through a payroll tax that the public supports since it understands the great benefits that accrue to everyone. There are many options. The United States has the most income inequality of all rich nations. For example, the top 25 earning hedge fund managers make more income combined than all the kindergarten teachers in this country. Is that fair? As mentioned, President Obama has stated that income inequality is the defining challenge of our time. And Pope Francis called it the root of all social evils. And he said, this economy kills. Many studies show that inequality is linked to worse health outcomes through a variety of mechanisms, including making social comparisons. The Institute of Medicine report highlights inequality as a major health issue. Just as we looked at the population as the entity to consider above, so we can treat populations with so-called population medicine. There are many strategies for changing our obscene inequality. Decreasing inequality in our society is such a medicine, so I want to explore strategies for that. The government funds a great deal of research that we pay for. And then the result of that research, when it becomes profitable, are handed to industry without requiring them to repay us for the technological innovations they used to make record profits. The iPhone is a great example. The computer another, as was the Internet, which was developed by we the people through government-funded research. We could set up a process by which profitable companies repay us for providing them the basic science and engineering that allowed them to prosper. Companies are incredibly wealthy today and don't invest their profits, but hang on to them. So they could afford to pay us for giving them the means through which they used those technologies to gain record profits. Our concept of capitalism and the free market with the invisible hand suggesting that we each pursue our individual greed is a falsehood. Every nation state has the government intervening to make it easier for businesses through subsidies and tax breaks. Corporations pay piddling taxes today, and our health is the loss for it. Another example is government support of philanthropies through tax avoidance. Seattle hosts the Gates Foundation, the largest philanthropy in the world. Rich people can avoid paying taxes by setting up these institutions, and then they get to control how the money is spent. The Gates Foundation supports technological innovation that may not do much to help the poor. They also make grants to profit-making corporations, all perfectly legal, of course. And Bill and Melinda Gates decide how to spend the money. The public is left out of this process. If we consider the tax breaks they get and ask, what if the huge amount of money, in the tens of billions of dollars that we lose in taxes, could go to the government and it's there to spend through our democratic process? We the people might decide to spend them on something other than a $1,000 toilet for poor people championed by Gates. We could spend it on paid parental leave that would benefit all of us. The key point is that there's no such thing as a free gift. Philanthrocapitalism may not be good for us. As well as a minimum wage, we need a maximum wage. Such a concept came close to reality in the United States back in 1942 when President Roosevelt proposed a maximum wage of $25,000 by having 100% tax on income above that amount. What passed was a 94% marginal tax on incomes above $25,000. And that amount, $25,000, is about $500,000 today. Many of us could live on that if we had to. The tax was raised to 96% in 1946. In 1950s, it was clawed down to 91%. Back then, our society was much less unequal, and we almost had a maximum wage. So such a proposal is not un-American. Executive pay could be capped at 10 or 20 times that of the lowest paid worker in that firm, instead of being close to 500 times that today. That is something that Japan and other nations do, namely limit top incomes. Besides a progressive tax on incomes, we need a substantial tax on wealth and one on inheritances. These are what Thomas Piketty describes as utopian ideas in his best-selling Capital in the 21st Century. He means it. I grew up in the 1960s when we had utopian ideals in the United States. Most rich countries give a child benefit to every family regularly to keep children out of poverty. I have a colleague who moved from the Balkans to Norway in the 1990s with his family comprising three children, including a toddler. Upon arriving, every child received a monthly check from the government as an asset building account. Of course, it was paid to the parents and not to the toddler. Alaska is the only state to do something like this with its permanent fund. In Alaska, it pays an amount annually based on the income from oil royalties to each person resident there. This is over $2,000 per person last year. For a family of four, say, it represents a substantial amount. That's the concept of a guaranteed income. In 1969, President Nixon proposed the Family Assistance Plan to provide a floor for income for everyone in this country. He proposed a guaranteed income. At that time, 94% of the media approved of this idea, passed the House of Representatives, and languished in the Senate. Nixon got embroiled in Watergate and lost interest in shepherding it through. We were that close to having a guaranteed income in this country. To summarize, we passed through the first era of health when we were concerned with infectious diseases and our first era of healthcare treating infections by various means, be they TB sanatoria or antibiotics or prevented them with immunizations. With that progress, we came to the second era of health, recognizing that in later stages of this sexually transmitted infection of life, we had to deal with chronic diseases, the conditions that many of us have here tonight. The second era of health care was less effective in impacting the second era of health since medical care could only maintain us with our chronic diseases, despite our trying to modify personal behaviors. And medical care cannot cure most of these chronic conditions. We've entered the third era of health, where not only do we want to be as healthy as those in other rich nations, we want them to be meaningful years and we want to accomplish our goals. So we need to consider the third era of health care. Note, this is not the third era of health, but health care, as vastly different from the first and second ones. How life, the sexually transmitted infection, evolved depends on conditions that began before we were conceived, before we were born, and before we entered school. It's too much to ask individuals to choose their grandparents wisely. But society can make this choice through its political policies that must be kept in place for generations. We need to embrace concepts of population health and population medicine and focus on the early years. Think of inequality in our society as an odorless, colorless, invisible, highly toxic gas that we're unaware of harming our health. Kills us through the usual diseases we die from. Cardiovascular disease such as heart attacks and strokes, cancers, diabetes, kidney and lung disease. These conditions have their origins in early life, and we're among the worst rich nations in terms of supporting early life, and that is when the inequality gas is most toxic. We need to be rescued from this gas, and only we can rescue our future generations so they have the healthy lives they deserve. Other countries can teach us about this third era of health. Countries that have social policies in place that protect all families, grandparents, parents, children, and future generations will be healthier than those that focus on the here and now. These societal policies need to decrease economic inequality and spend the revenue thus gained on various forms of supporting early life. And the first such policy is universal paid parental leave. Our first step coming out of tonight is to confront our being dead first. We must bring this up for discussion, as most people in this country are unaware of this killer fact. This will lead to more questions that we must become informed about to answer. When asked why we are dead first, we must downplay the role of medical care and highlight the importance of the first 1,000 days. We can do this within our network of family and friends. We can do this in the workplace and in the various organizations such as this one in which we participate. We can use the technology of social media as well. We must recognize, as Rudolf Virchow said 150 years ago, that medicine is a social science and politics nothing but medicine on a larger scale. We need to engage politically to best treat this sexual infection so that our lives can be meaningful and fulfilling. We must build strong children rather than repair broken men and women. So go forth and tell everyone we all die too young, and we as a more equitable society are the medicine we need. Thank you.
That was Stephen Bezruchka, In Sickness and in Wealth. He spoke in Port Townsend, Washington. Stephen Bezruchka is senior lecturer in the Department of Global Health at the University of Washington. He worked for many years as an emergency physician in Seattle. This program is produced by Alternative Radio, based in Boulder, Colorado, celebrating 30 years of independent broadcasting. We are supported solely by individuals just like you. Among our more than 1,000 programs, we have a series featuring Dr. Stephen Bezruchka. To access our complete audio and book catalog, just go to our website, alternativeradio.org. Again, our website where we are podcasting, alternativeradio.org. To place a credit card order for a CD, MP3, or written transcript of today's program, Stephen Bezruchka, In Sickness and in Wealth, call us at 1-800-444-1977. Again, that number is 1-800-444-1977. Or you can order on our website, alternativeradio.org. The Kronos Quartet performs our theme music from Pieces of Africa. Joe Ritchie is our general manager and editor. I'm David Barsamian. Thank you for listening.